Welcome back to the program. The level of economic inequality in America today exceeds every other Western nation. It is ironic when one realizes that it was the rise of the middle class that built post-war America. So what's happened in three generations, in just 60 years, that has so stratified the nation, that makes Wall Street look like Versailles in the age of Louis XIV, and in 2008 almost drove the economy off the cliff? Perhaps Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko captured it best 25 years ago in the movie Wall Street.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA.
We're going to spend some time today talking about this level of inequality, what John Kenneth Galbraith called the moral justification for selfishness. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Linda McQuaig. She's the author of 7 Canadian bestsellers, a winner of the National Newspaper Award. She's been a national reporter for the Globe and Mail, a senior writer for Maclean's magazine, and a political columnist for the Toronto Star. It is my pleasure to welcome Linda McQuaig here to talk about her new book, Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. Linda McQuaig, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot. Very nice to be here,
Jeff. Delight to have you. It does seem that in 60 years of the middle class shrinking, of the 1% or 1/10th percent gaining more and more economic and political power, that by and large people don't seem to be concerned. And in fact, those that have suffered the most with this change have been the least aggressive in wanting to deal with it.
Well, I think there's a lot of confusion out there about exactly what's going on and everything, but I'm not sure I agree with you that there's, not much concern. I mean, I think, first of all, you know, what you saw with Occupy Wall Street was clearly an expression of concern, and that seemed to resonate quite broadly throughout society. I mean, the polls showed there was tremendous support for it. And even, you know, just the other day we saw that thing with Citibank, the shareholders, they're voting against a compensation package that they thought was outrageously high. You know, like, I actually, and the poll, there's other polls showing that Americans are strongly in favor of the Buffett rule. So I think there's actually quite a bit of evidence that Americans actually do care about this rising inequality. I mean, the problem has been just politically. You know, there's been such resistance to actually making changes that, you know, like taxing the rich higher. I think Americans are for that. It's just hard to put it in place given the Republican opposition to it.
And also given the way political power has changed, the way economic power has had an impact on laws and on the democratic process.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, what's been really clear in the last 30 years, when you talk about, you know, going back 60 years, the big changes, of course, started happening about 30 years ago. And one of the big changes with the whole Reagan Revolution and everything that that brought has been an enormous power gain by you know, the economic and financial interests, and partly brought about by just their very, you know, well-financed lobbying efforts and how increasingly legislators listen to them. And I think to a certain extent, I mean, it's a bit circular because I think that greater power that they had, that they have, is a reflection of the fact that they have more money. You know, if you go back to that early post-war period, you know, from about 1945 to 1980, that was a period where, you know, the U.S. was a much more egalitarian society. Money was distributed much more equally, both through the tax system and also just generally through the economy, through jobs and wages. And back then, the middle class just had a larger share of the national income. The share enjoyed by the top 1% was much smaller. So the middle class had more political clout. You know, when you have more economic power, that translates to political power. And so one of the things we've seen is that as money has increasingly concentrated at the top in recent years, with that has come enormous political power for the top 1% and higher. And that's really, in many ways, the most damaging aspect of this rise in inequality.
And yet we've even seen the rise in inequality, and a lot of these things that we're talking about have happened, for example, in Canada as well, where the economic influence, the power of money in the political process is not as great.
Oh, but it's actually in Canada, it's becoming greater. Canada's very much followed in the footsteps of the U.S. I mean, it's interesting, though, that, you know, when you talk about this trend, the trend towards greater inequality is really very much a phenomena of, you know, the Anglo-American countries, if you want to call them that, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Britain. Or, sorry, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. And what you've seen, the United States being the most extreme example, but Britain and Canada following in close pursuit. And what you've seen is, you know, again, this sort of giving up on a much more equal society with much more redistribution. That was very pronounced in Canada, for instance. And we've moved away from that. We have the same problem with the concentration of incomes at the very top.
Talk a little bit about the ways in which this concentration has come about, because it didn't happen overnight. It happened over a protracted period of time, and it's a little like the frog in the boiling water.
Yeah, that's true. Although, you know, I think there's a tendency to think the sort of conventional wisdom or arguments that you hear is that basically it's a it's the result of globalization. You know, we live in a global economy, so as a result of that, you know, everything's more competitive, and that's kind of driven up pay for those, the talented ones at the top. And in fact, I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support that. I mean, partly because, as I was just pointing out, this pattern of extreme concentration of income at the top is really a phenomena you see mostly in the U.S., Britain, and Canada. So in other words, countries that are also experiencing globalization and competing in the global economy, the European countries, Japan, other parts of the advanced world, are not experiencing to anywhere the same extent. So I think the globalization factor has been greatly exaggerated. I think it has much more to do, and what we trace in the book is that it has much more to do with actual political changes, actual policy changes. So, for instance, one of the biggest differences is the rise of incomes on Wall Street, like in the financial sector. And that relates directly to the deregulation of financial markets. I mean, you can trace as the financial changes were brought about, the deregulation was brought about, incomes just started shooting through the roof. So that's a deliberate deliberate choice, but it was a deliberate result of excessive lobbying by very powerful interests. Similarly, on the corporate side, the biggest change has been executive stock options, not globalization, it's executive stock options. And, and they became extremely popular, and they were structured in a way that was wildly lucrative to the executive and not very good for the company. And it's interesting to note that wasn't, for instance, the way they've been structured in Europe. In Europe, they're structured, basically the executive isn't able to cash the option in whenever he wants or whenever he or she wants. Mm-hmm. And so it's not as advantageous. And they haven't resulted in the same kind of huge incomes at the top in Europe. These are deliberate choices that have been made as a result of the very powerful lobbying by special interest groups.
We've seen this here across the board. I mean, you talk about Wall Street, the banking industry, corporate CEOs, and in sports and entertainment as well, this incredible escalation of salaries.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's simply phenomenal. But in a way, certainly the celebrities and the sports figures are, you know, very dramatic and interesting. But in fact, the majority of these, of the big changes, like the majority of those, something like 66% of those in the top 0.01% are actually financial and corporate executives. So while the athletes draw, you know, they're a tiny, tiny portion mm-hmm. that make up this very wealthy elite. So you really have to look at what's going on with this corporate and financial elite. And they're the ones that have been so big, so effective in, you know, lobbying and bringing about these changes. And they're the ones that have, you know, amassed the huge rewards.
So what is it about the nature, the aspirational nature, perhaps, of the Anglo countries, of the U.S. and Canada and Britain, that has allowed this to happen and allowed large swatches of the population to be supportive of it?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that large segments of the population really are supportive of it. In fact, there's some fascinating research that's been done by a number of political scientists, we quote them in the book, that really show that, in fact, when it comes to issues like, oh, like income inequality, like the role of government and how extensive the role of government should be, that, in fact, this notion that there's been a big shift to the right, it just isn't true among the broad mass of the American public. That, in fact, you know, like the, let's say, the rise of the Republican vote is more reflective of their success in on the social issues and the cultural issues. And that, in fact, when it comes to the sort of economic issues, at least in terms of, you know, how much intervention you want by the state and do you want a progressive tax system, that sort of thing, there isn't this big shift to the right. In fact, there's also a fascinating study done out of by a group of people, but in, basically done out of Harvard just last year that showed, it was fascinating, it was looking at Americans and what they, what their ideal was of, for income distribution. And they sort of structured it in a way so that they provided, you know, different pies, and the Americans could choose which division of the pie they preferred without knowing which pie represented America and which pie, for instance, in one case represented Sweden, which is much more egalitarian. And Americans, something like 92% of Americans chose the Swedish division of the pie. They didn't realize it was Sweden, or they probably would have thought, oh, that's wrong. But just the way, you know, it seemed much fairer to them. It's not totally equal by any means, but it seemed fairer than the very unequal division of the American pie, and that actually appealed to them by huge mm-hmm. numbers. So I guess what I'm saying is, I think what there has happened in America is more a political problem in terms of how effective certain interest groups with the backing heavily of the Republican Party have been in kind of getting control of the political situation and blocking reforms. I don't think it's to do with the changes in public attitudes.
And yet we've, you know, there's the what's the matter with Kansas phenomenon,
yeah, yeah.
where people essentially vote against their own economic interest.
Yeah, but again, a lot of that is because they're, you know, the Republicans, for instance, have been very effective in highlighting issues that aren't even necessarily economic, but have to do with you know, things they feel very strongly, abortion, you know, various sort of social and cultural. We've seen that in the Republican primaries, just how much those issues actually dominate and how deeply a lot of people seem to care about them. And, you know, I think to a certain extent, if you keep the focus on that sort of thing, you know, Americans, You miss the fact that Americans haven't moved dramatically to the right on the economic issues.
Is the problem in part also that progressives have not made an effective case for an egalitarian society?
You know what? That is actually totally true, and we do make that argument in the book. That,
mm-hmm.
And I do think that is an important point to make, in the sense that essentially what the right has done, I mean, the right has positions that if you think about them at all, they're kind of intrinsically unappealing to ordinary voters, you know, to, you know, they, They basically involve, you know, big pools of capital at the top and the trickle-down argument. Oh, you'll benefit eventually. And when you think about it, that's not very appealing to people. But the right has been very powerful in selling this. I mean, partly they've had huge financial resources in terms of you know, think tanks and ownership of the media and all that sort of thing. Whereas the progressive side, which has positions that are, you know, kind of intrinsically appealing to ordinary people, and that they're much more egalitarian, they're much more focused on job growth and everybody in the community benefiting, have kind of retreated in recent years from kind of selling their positions. In fact, the best example of this, I think, has been around the death tax, so-called, the inheritance tax. You know, that was the inheritance tax going all the way back to the early 1900s was just an absolute fixture of American politics. It was accepted by both Republicans and the Democrats as being fair. But in recent years, there's been this push by, you know, the anti-tax side to get rid of it. And they've labeled it the death tax, you know, to make people not like it because it seems unfair to dying people. Whereas, in fact, it's the most fair of all the taxes because it only hits the top 1%. And these, you know, it's taxing money that has just been given to people through no effort of their own, just as what Warren Buffett calls the ovarian lottery, the luck of being born into a wealthy family. It's a wonderful tax in that sense. It raises revenue without hurting anyone badly, and it just really, you know, prevents this enormous transfer of wealth from generation to generation to go untaxed. There's tremendous arguments to make to defend it. But instead of mounting those arguments, progressives have kind of folded their tent and just kind of let the anti-tax movement, you know, swarm over them. And so we've come to the point that, you know, it's not clear if the inheritance tax will survive. There's been so much of a push against it. But I think you're absolutely right. That's because, you know, the progressive movement has absolutely failed to get out there and really defend it. I mean, you know, you can go all the way back to 1906 and Theodore Roosevelt, you know, a Republican president, you know, is an ardent defender of the inheritance tax. He talks about it as a, you know, it's necessary to tax the swollen fortunes of the wealthy that are no benefit to this country to perpetuate as a dynasty, you know, as dynasties. I mean, it's some very powerful stuff, but you don't ever hear that kind of thing today.
Right, because there are two countervailing narratives, and as we're talking about, the egalitarian narrative has gone lacking, while the right has been able to sell an aspirational narrative that's not unlike, if you'll pardon the metaphor, it's not unlike pornography. It's that, you know, if you go along with this, this can be you as well.
Yeah, well, no doubt they have said that, but the numbers are in. I mean, if we want to be at all accurate, you know, after 30 years of these trickle-down policies, they always argued that, you know, this would be beneficial for everyone. They just haven't been. I mean, the numbers are just staggering. The income growth among, you know, ordinary citizens has been stagnant for 30 years. The economy has continued to grow, but unlike in the post-war period where it was widely shared, it's gone all to the top 10%, but particularly to the top 1% and higher. You know, so that whole mythology that the right has been trying to sell, you know, I mean, it's just not true. And I think increasingly the message is getting out that it isn't true and that, you know, they're selling dreams. I mean, among other things, I mean, one of the big arguments has been the, you know, the American dream, right? The idea that everybody has a chance to get ahead. And I think to a certain extent, Americans love that idea, I think. And rightly so. The idea that you can be born into poverty, but, you know, this is a land of opportunity, and with hard work you can get ahead. Well, in fact, the evidence shows that as societies become more unequal, there's less and less possibility of upward mobility. And that is totally true in the United States. The numbers, again, are very clear that in the post-war period, there was upward mobility. There was significant opportunity for ordinary people, but not anymore. That there's the United States has one of the lowest levels of upward mobility of any of the advanced nations. You know, the irony is, if you want to live the American dream, you should move to Sweden, because they actually do have upward mobility there.
Because things are as far out of whack as they are, it's hard then for progressives to make the case for what comes down to redistribution of wealth, a concept and an idea that often doesn't play well.
I don't agree with you, and I think the polls bear me out that, in fact, poll after poll, and, you know, I just saw one yesterday, a CNN poll, saying 72% favored the Buffett rule, including 53% of Republicans even. In fact, and I've seen this polling going back really quite, going back the past 10 years, you can see that people favor, Americans favor, higher taxes on the rich. So I don't think there is this resistance to redistribution. I mean, for one thing, it's not even just a question that, it seems fairer, to distribute gains more widely, but there's massive evidence that it's way better for the economy. I mean, one of the problems now with the lack of recovery is that, in fact, you have lots of money in pools of capital held by those at the top and by corporations, but they're not investing it. And the reason they're not investing it is because so many Americans are in such financial difficulty. There's not much of a market among the middle class. The middle class doesn't have rising income. It has stagnant income, and many parts of it are declining incomes. So what's the point in investing to sell to those people when they don't have the resources? So, in fact, a broader distribution of income creates more demand for products, which, fuels the economic growth. I mean, that's one of the reasons, and that's what's so ironic, again, that early period, that early post-war period, where taxes were much higher, was actually a period of phenomenal economic growth. In fact, those were the decades of highest economic growth the U.S. has ever seen before or since. And I think the reason is that income was more widely distributed. There was, much more demand for goods because ordinary Americans had money and were ready to buy things, and that caused investment. So, it's not even just a question that, it's fairer for everyone if the money is spread around more. It's actually better for the economy. I mean, not to mention that it's also way better for all kinds of other social and health indicators. It's just there's just extensive evidence showing that societies that are more equal have much better, social and health outcomes than societies that are less equal.
The way that happens is through tax policy.
Yeah.
And one thing that the right has done a really good job of is demonizing the whole idea of any kind of taxes.
Yeah, the right has, that has been their big thing, right, is the demonization of taxes. And I think you're right. In general, there's been this sort of notion that taxes are so bad and the demonization of taxes. But again, if you look at the polling, when you sort of break it out, and of course those pushing the anti-tax agenda never want you to break it out. They want to imply, with the Bush tax cuts, he made it sound as if, there were tax cuts for everybody, but the tax cuts for people in the lower and middle class were tiny, tiny. And the tax cuts for those at the top were huge. And that's typical. If you look at, let's take Mitt Romney's tax cut plan, okay? There's a fascinating breakdown of it done by the Tax Policy Center in Washington, and it shows like it's a 20% across-the-board tax cut. Okay, so that sounds maybe to a lot of people like it's very fair. But in fact, what that means is that the people in the bottom 20%, well, actually, due to some changes that, you know, will come in as a result, they'll actually lose money. They'll actually end up paying an extra $149 a year in tax on average, whereas the people in the top 0.1%, like the very richest of the rich, they will save on average. Now, get this, it's just mind-boggling, but I have these numbers right in front of me from their table. The top 0.1% will save on average $725,000. So in other words, you know, this notion that, yes, the right has demonized taxes, and they've gotten away with it, like they got away with it with the Bush tax cuts, but I do think it's catching up to people. I do think that Occupy Wall Street, just sort of the general, partly Obama's made this into a big issue. I think people are catching on that you talk about an across-the-board tax cut. That means enormous benefits at the top and really very little benefits for anyone else. Another just a fascinating set of numbers. If they close the loopholes, like the special tax treatment of capital gains, the people in the bottom 20% would on average receive a benefit, get this, of $1 on average, because they don't have any capital gains generally. But the people in the top 1% would receive on average a benefit of $27,000. So, I mean, you know, this attempt to demonize taxes has been effective, but to some extent, but I think it's becoming clearer to more people, and certainly I'm trying to do my best to also, you know, make it as clear as possible that, you know, demonizing taxes is really a ploy about benefiting those at the upper end, and it really does nothing. In fact, it hurts those at the bottom end because it means less revenue for government, and therefore less revenue for government to invest in, you know, public programs that benefit people, and also in you know, investing in things like infrastructure.
How wide does this inequality gap have to become before it becomes totally self-destructive, before there really is some kind of extreme reaction to it?
Yeah, well, okay, those are two separate questions in a way. Like, I think it's already extremely destructive. I think it's already just doing terrible things to the fabric of American society. And, you know, as I say, if you look at the numbers about the health and social outcomes and just how far behind America is falling to other advanced nations, it's really quite staggering. But you're also raising the question, and the other area, of course, that it's having so much impact, this rising inequality, is on democracy. You know, I mean, look at what the power of the wealthy in changing all these policies, you know, like with the Citizens United mm-hmm. decision, and the fact that we now have a presidential election in which, you know, so much seems to depend on the whims of billionaires and what they want to finance. This is very undermining of democracy. So that's one issue, and I think we've already reached a kind of really kind of critical point in the U.S. I mean, but you know, you raise another question: at what point will it trigger a response? You know, that is a really interesting question. I see signs that it's starting to trigger a response. I mean, obviously the outcome of this election will be crucial, you know, on this issue. But I think you're already seeing signs that it's kind of reached a tipping point where it's kind of gone beyond just the margins and is actually kind of spilling over. This concern about extreme inequalities spilling over into the broad mainstream.
Linda McQuaig, her book is Billionaire's Ball, Gluttony and Hubris in an Age of Epic Inequality. It's just out from Beacon Press. Linda, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure.